Where should we park? Depending on where you live and work, parking may be something you think about a lot. It's certainly something urban planners need to think about. Already, some 5% of all urban land in the U.S. is dedicated to parking. And with every new residential or commercial development that goes up, figuring out what to do with cars is a key consideration. Here with a penetrating look at how car and parking have deranged our landscape is Henry Grabar, author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. Henry is a staff writer at Slate Magazine, and he joins us now to share five of his big ideas.
Hi there. I'm Henry Grabar, a journalist who writes the Metropolis column for Slate. I'm also the author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. I'm going to share five key insights from my book. Insight number one, there is a lot of parking in this country. There are between 4 and 9 parking spots for each car. There is more parking per car than there is housing per person. In Los Angeles County, for example, there are 19 million parking spots, 14% of incorporated land in the county. That's more land than the moving lanes on the streets and the freeways put together. In Silicon Valley, the wealthiest region of the United States, parking is 13% of the land. There are 15 million parking spots in the Bay, enough to wrap a parking lane around the Earth, twice. The smaller the city, the more parking there is relative to the population. Seattle, for example, has 5 parking spaces per household, but Des Moines, Iowa, has 20 per household. Parking makes up 28% of the land in Louisville and 29% of downtown Kansas City. And that's excluding garages inside or underneath buildings and not counting curb parking. In the mid-aughts, when the team of programmers at Maxis were working on the first new SimCity game in a decade, they studied American municipal architecture, politics, and urban design to try and produce a compelling simulacrum. Lead designer Stone LeBrand used Google Earth to measure his surroundings. The biggest surprise he found was the size of the parking lots. Quote, "When I started measuring out our local grocery store, which I don't think of as being that big, I was blown away by how much more space was parking lot rather than actual store," he said. "That was kind of a problem because we were originally just going to model real cities, but we quickly realized there were way too many parking lots in the real world, and that our game was going to be really boring if it was proportional in terms of parking lots. In the game," he said, "they tried to imagine that the parking was underground. We had to do the best we could," he said, "and still make the game look attractive." Insight number two, ample parking has costs. Worse still, in most jurisdictions, all this parking is required by law. Every restaurant, office, pool hall, library, courthouse, laundromat, and so on, must come with a precise number of parking spaces. Most importantly, every new house or apartment must also come with a set number of parking spaces. These zoning laws have had huge consequences. They make it impossible to reuse old buildings, compelling demolitions that tear away at the historic fabric of our cities. For a century, American architecture has evolved in tandem with parking laws, as increasing quantities of required parking have forced developers to move from the early 20th century vernacular, corner taverns and storefront groceries, row houses and three flats, triple deckers and bungalow courts, to more modern styles, including fast food chains, big box stores, and houses whose primary architectural feature is the garage door. All this required parking has had huge effects on transportation, functioning as an enormous subsidy for car ownership. Parking has created an urban landscape so divided by lots that it is difficult or dangerous to use transit, walk, or ride a bicycle. Parking minimums are like some mutant strain of yeast in the city dough, inflating and expanding architecture and urbanism with bubbles of asphalt. And the more we drive, the more parking we crave. In the early days, certainly, parking facilities like garages arose in response to demand. But later, thwarting the hopes of the planners who decided to require parking in every new building, they began to create demand. Research has shown that parking growth between 1960 and 1980 was a powerful predictor of car use in the following two decades. In other words, more parking appeared to cause more driving, not the other way around. Finally, these parking mandates are, of course, terrible for the environment, since they pave so much land. That changes the way cities interact with rainfall, heat, and wildlife. And needless to say, all this parking, most of it unused most of the time, is also a huge waste of the resources that go into creating asphalt and concrete. Insight number three, parking has a literal cost too. You don't pay for parking when you park most of the time, but someone does. A little bit of every bar tab, grocery bill, and most importantly, your rent or mortgage payment is going towards paying for parking. It might seem like the easiest thing in the world to build, but parking is actually pretty expensive. Surface parking costs a few thousand dollars a stall, not including the land it takes up. Garage parking costs tens of thousands of dollars a stall. Underground parking, that can run you into the six figures per space. Multiply those figures by all the parking we've built, and you come to an astonishing conclusion. Our parking stock is probably worth more than all our cars put together. No surprise, this has tacked on a massive expense to everything we build, especially in housing. No surprise, this has tacked on a massive expense to everything we build, which is especially important with housing. Required parking adds tens of thousands of dollars to the cost of low-income apartments. It raises big city rents by double-digit percentages. Don't have a car? You pay for it anyway. It's impossible to understate how much this changes the kinds of things we can build. When Seattle recently decided to stop requiring developers to include new parking in homes near transit, the results were intriguing. Most developers still built parking, but they built a lot less than they used to. Over just 6 years, they built 60,000 fewer parking spaces than the law would have previously required. That lowered the cost to build those new apartment buildings by $500 million. Insight number four, free street parking is a disaster. Why do we have these crazy rules? Because we've neglected to manage one of a city's most valuable and important resources, the curb. When you make something popular free, you will soon run out of it. This happens every day where curb parking is free in busy neighborhoods. Employees show up first thing in the morning, take all the best spots, and park all day long. Customers who come later to eat a meal or run an errand find there's nothing left. Pretty soon, free parking for me has become a parking shortage for thee. Then comes double parking, parking tickets, traffic jams, and lost time. Or worse, customers taking their business to malls with ample parking in the suburbs. How much downtown traffic is created by looking for parking? About a third. That's a lot of driving. Consider data from Westwood Village, a commercial neighborhood in Los Angeles. It only took drivers 3 minutes to find parking. But multiply that by the hundreds of people coming and going every hour, it adds up to 35 hours of cruising for parking every single hour. The average hunt distance was a half mile. In other words, this single neighborhood, with its 15 blocks of 470 underpriced parking meters, was generating 3,600 extra miles of driving every single day. And when people don't easily find parking, they fight about it. Dozens of people are killed in parking space murders every year. Properly price your curb parking, on the other hand, and it becomes possible to find a space where you want it, when you want it. When San Francisco started charging more for curb parking on its busiest streets a few years ago, parking citations actually went down, maybe because it was easier to park, or because people thought they were getting something worth paying for. Insight number five, there are people who are obsessed with parking. I know the picture I've painted so far is pretty grim, but there's a whole movement of people trying to fix this state of affairs. They call themselves Shoopistas, after Don Shoop, a professor at the University of California in Los Angeles, whose research on parking started a movement. The Shupistas are designers, environmentalists, developers, planners, pedestrians, and small business owners, restaurateurs and food trucks, startup founders doing e-commerce, and hippies riding bicycles, people who don't drive or don't want to. They come from the left, frustrated by a hidden nationwide subsidy for fossil fuels and enraged by the hurdles to building low-income housing, and the right, thwarted by laws that tell you what to do with your property with dubious justification. Preservationists who wish to see old buildings find second life, they're Shupistas. And so are anti-preservationists who want to see new buildings everywhere. Shupistas include free marketeers who want dynamic parking pricing, but also good government advocates who want more revenue for public improvements. The Yes in My Backyard YIMBY pro-housing activists, they're often Shupistas. And so are the small city restorationists of the Strong Towns movement, who wish to see the urban fabric in small towns recover its early 20th century glory. Architects who subscribe to the Congress for New Urbanism, well, they're Shupistas too. All these people have solutions to make our American parking situation better. But I'll save those for the book. It's in part the story of how we destroyed our cities in search of parking, and the people who helped make it so. The mall builders and the mobsters, the police and the politicians, the garage magnates and the community groups. But it is also a chronicle of those who have begun to repair the damage, waging an unpopular war to take parking down a notch on America's hierarchy of needs and restore the space it took from us. Not all the way down, mind you. I've read more books about car culture than I care to count, and I'm continually struck by how poorly they have aged. Their disdain for the suburbs and the people who live there is condescending at best, and, in light of today's urban real estate prices, newly classist. I come to bury that rhetoric, not to praise it. This book proposes an honest reckoning with the externalities of cars, but it is not anti-car. Parking has made an awful mess of the American city, but drivers are not the architects of this system. In a way, they are its victims. Driving may feel like freedom, but our inability to get around any other way is a kind of prison. I do, however, take it as a first principle that most people would like to be able to leave the car behind once in a while, to travel on foot, on a bike, with a kid on rollerblades or a baby in a stroller, on a bus that comes when you need it and goes somewhere you want to be. A better approach to parking will make that possible. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy Paved Paradise.
Thank you, Henry. That was Henry Grabar with 5 big ideas from Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.